From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's a best of health show today, starting with a musical way to get in shape.
Then, when it comes to getting back into shape after pregnancy, well, what can you realistically expect?
Keep in mind, it took you 9 months to get there. It'll take you a minimum of 9 months to get back, if not longer. So it's not a quick fix. It's not what you see in magazines. You know, it's a long process.
Later, when it comes to studying coffee and your health, where do scientists begin?
A lot of these studies for the benefits were done on up to 3 8-ounce cups of coffee. And that seems to be fine for most people. For me, I'll hit a point where a little's good, and I will go over that point and know it.
And we'll learn about local efforts to reduce black infant mortality and improve birth outcomes. Lake Effect is next. News is first. Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. That might sound like a recording of a concert, but it's actually an exercise class that combines the elements of music and drumming into an effective way of elevating your heart rate.
Pound is a full-body workout that combines cardio, conditioning, and strength training with low-impact movements. Created by recreational drummers and former athletes, this new format has grown from its first class in a Los Angeles basement into a global network.
For this month's Fit for You, local fitness instructor and Pound Pro Erica Lewandowski joined me in the studio to explain how people can drum their way into better shape.
Pound is a full-body cardio jam session that uses lightly weighted drumsticks called ripsticks to allow our participants to become a part of the music by drumming, all while toning their body from head to toe.
So, by drumming, what kind of equipment is there? I assume there's sticks of some sort.
Yep, we use special drumsticks called ripsticks. They're bright green drumsticks. You can't miss them. They are made specifically for Pound. They're twice the weight of an average drumstick and a little bit fatter than a regular drumstick, but just about the same length. So you really do get the feel as though you're an actual drummer throughout the workout.
And I imagine they were designed so that they don't break if
yeah,
they're getting into it.
Yeah, they're really durable. They can take a beating. They are there to allow you to have a good time and rock out and not worry about it.
All right, so this is to music. People have drumsticks to go along with it. So what areas of the body does Pound utilize and through what kind of moves? What are you looking for when people are using these sticks?
Well, we combine Pilates, isometric movements, plyometric movements, and strength training poses into drumming. So you might be doing things like squats or lunges or a seated position where you're really engaging your abs. But the beauty of it is you don't really realize that you're doing that because you're drumming and you're engaged in this great music with this loud drum beat. So you really forget that you're working out entirely.
So I imagine with the lunges and in the seated position, is this a low-impact workout?
Yeah, it is. It is low-impact. You don't need to jump. Your feet can stay on the ground the whole time, and we can modify it for any type of individual that comes into our classes.
We'll get back to modifications a little later, but to start, what are the physical benefits of Pound? So what is the class structure like? Is it about an hour or so?
It's typically a 45-minute class, but we can also do as short as a 30-minute class if that fits best into a schedule. And like any exercise class, you're going to get wonderful cardiovascular benefits and strength training benefits. But one of the things that we really like so much in Pound is how it affects our participants' mind, body, and what we call inner rock star. So we know that they're getting a great workout. We know that they're getting all those health benefits, calorie burning, muscle endurance, muscle strengthening. But what you see that's so unique with Pound is they come away from classes really empowered. We want our participants to leave with confidence, feeling really good about themselves, and really going out into their community and continuing our culture of empowerment for others.
So to get to the nitty-gritty physical aspects, how many calories on average are burned in one session?
We say about 800 per hour, but of course it's going to depend a little bit on how hard the participant is working and at what level we have them working at.
And the main muscles targeted, I imagine there's a lot of legwork with lunges and being in that kind of position, but do you really notice your arms getting a good workout through drumming?
Absolutely. I actually thought the reverse. I thought when I started, oh, I'm holding these weighted drumsticks, so I'm going to see it mostly in my arms and my shoulders, and I do. People that start this class come back and they say, you know, I wore a tank top this weekend, and people were commenting on how strong my arms looked and how great my shoulders looked, and it kind of catches people off guard. But you also absolutely are getting the workout in your legs, in your quads, in your glutes, of course, because you're doing a lot of lunges and squats. So you really get the full body workout without even realizing you're doing it.
And I imagine it's good for not only physical but mental endurance.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things is when you have a class that has such a strong drum beat to it, you really get yourself sort of lost into the music. And so we call it therapy for some people because they go in, there's 45 minutes of time just focused on them. It's them and the music and whatever challenges they want to present to themselves or however they just want to relax into the music, it's totally up to them so that they can come away and get exactly what they need from the class.
Are people hesitant at all at first if it's an initial class or they're just learning it, you know, thinking, I'm not coordinated enough to try and follow along with the music? And do you see that improve over time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everybody does walk through the door and a lot of them say, I don't have rhythm or I've never done this. But what's interesting is they come in the door. They are still really excited to try it out because they've seen it through the window or they've heard about it from a friend and they really want to give it a try. So they're willing to give it a shot. Over time, we see them come back and they'll even say, you know, I kind of feel like a drummer. I think I could actually be a drummer. I'm pretty sure if you put me in front of a drum kit, I could even be a drummer. So we can take them from that very beginning step all the way to full-on rock star if we're doing our jobs right.
So if they're getting to that level of confidence, I imagine they're getting used to a certain type of class structure. So walk me through, what does the initial start of the class look like with warm-up, and how do you move through the class? I know there's, you mentioned there's squats. You can be in a seated position. So how do you move from one to the next?
Okay, we start every class with an introduction because we're always getting new students every time. So we start with our basic safety principles, how to hold the ripsticks, which is a little different from traditional drumsticks. We go over the four positions, which are a standing position called set, a standing position called lunge, which is pretty self-explanatory, a seated position called kit, which targets the abs and core, and then actually a supine position where you're laying on your back and it does a lot of simulated bridge type work.
Okay.
So we go through all those positions and we show the modifications as well so that any student, regardless of where they are in their fitness journey, can modify the movements back to where exactly they need to be. It is an intermittent style of training, so we start with the warm-up and slowly build in intensity and in muscle group engagement until we really kind of hit a peak, and then we drop it down a little bit, allow people to catch their breath a little bit, target slightly different muscles, and then we bring it up again. We kind of give our class the feeling that they're in a concert. That's what I always tell them. So you start with a song you know, right? That's the first song that an artist will play when they come out on stage. Then they may play another one that you know, and you start jamming out. And you get a little more excited, and then all of a sudden, oop, they stop for a moment, and they play something new that kind of slows you down, and you're listening, and you're curious what's coming next. We try to create that same type of intermittent style in our classes as well.
You mentioned modifications. What are some examples of how a person can modify, whether they're a seasoned pro and are able to do deeper lunges or something like that? And how do you take a new person or someone who perhaps has physical restrictions as to how much movement they can do?
Sure. So let's take a very basic move in our set position, which is just a standing position. Your legs are a little bit wider than your hips and shoulders, and you're basically going to go down to the ground in a squat, strike your ripsticks on the ground, and then come back up and strike your ripsticks overhead. For someone who needs a modification, because they might be starting out on their fitness journey or they're recuperating from an injury, we would encourage them to just not hit the ground. We still want them to engage in that good squat position so that they're targeting the muscles and they're safe in their movements, but they might stop at waist height. They might stop at shin height or knee height or thigh height. So they don't have to hit the ground to be a rock star. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, if you have somebody who really wants to push and get the most out of their workout, of course they're going to go into a nice deep squat, striking the ground with the ripsticks. But as they come up, they might employ plyometric movements and do a small jump as they're coming up, take their feet off of the ground and upping the intensity in that way.
Do you need to hit the ground to get an effective arm workout if someone is taking that modification and not striking the ground? Are they still working those same muscles striking in the air?
Oh, absolutely. Because the ripsticks are weighted, they're twice the weight of an average drumstick. Simply by holding something that's heavier and extending your arm length by about 16 inches on both sides, you're working that much harder to move your arms through the air and keep your body stabilized through the movement. So you will still see the workout without actually hitting the ground.
Throughout the time that you've been teaching us this class, why do you think this workout is so effective, and what made you want to take that next step to be an instructor?
Well, I'm kind of unique in that I became an instructor before I ever took a class.
Okay.
So my first class was the class actually at the training. And I did that because I started watching the brand online. We have a really loud social media presence. And I was hearing all this information about this really cool new program that was coming. And I was watching clips on YouTube and on social media. And I really wanted to experience it, but there really weren't any classes yet in the Milwaukee area. So I just drove myself down to Chicago and took the training. And my very first class was about 20 minutes into the training when they said, all right, grab these bright green drumsticks and let's have a class. I think the reason, though, that it engages so many people, and we do have a lot of students that become pound pros, which is what we call our instructors, is because we work so hard to make it accessible to everyone. We have a lot of instructors who have come on board who may or may not fit someone's typical, whatever that is, typical perception of what an instructor would be, because everyone has their own motivation and their own motivating story behind why they come into our program.
So what's your story?
My story was I saw it on social media and thought it looked really amazing and exciting and so different from anything I'd ever seen. I wanted to put myself into that new position of trying something so unique and different and see how it challenged me. And as soon as I started to see the results, I knew it was something I wanted to bring to my students.
How did this come about? Who created this program?
Well, this program was created in 2011 by two female drummers out in LA. They were recreational drummers who, throughout all of their lives, had been really involved in athletics and sports and dance. And for them, movement had always had a purpose, whether it was showing up for your practices and practicing to achieve a new routine or work together as a team to prepare for a meet. They were very used to that team mentality and that community that that created. As they grew older and became adults, started adulting, and had to continue their journey of just being healthy and going to the gym, they were really dissatisfied with their gym experience. This was out in LA, and they found it to be extremely body-centric. Classes were about how many calories were you going to burn and get rid of the muffin top and who could look the best in their workout gear. And while those classes achieved their purpose for our creators, who are Kirsten Potenza and Christina Pirenboom, they weren't really feeling it in their hearts, and it was a really big change for them. So they met at a party that happened to have a drum kit, and the drum kit didn't have a seat. So as they were hanging out, getting to know each other and jamming out, they were squatting in front of this drum kit. And the next morning, they woke up, and they were sore in all the right places. And that's sort of their light bulb moment. And from there, they started just sort of working with ideas, thinking of ways that they could incorporate drumming, which was one of their passions, with fitness, which was their other passion, and create a company and a culture that met all of the health goals, but also all of the mind-body type goals that they were looking to meet. They started in people's basements, they started practicing, and now we have over 8,000 instructors in 35 countries.
So in your personal experience, do you find that your group classes are a different kind of community compared to other classes that you've instructed or other classes that you've even participated in?
I really do. I am so humbled and blessed and surprised every time I look at my pound posse. That's what we call our whole pound community. We're called a pound posse. And it is some of the most genuine, kind, really generous people I have ever met. Typically when you start a class, you might ask the class, hey, is anybody here new today, so that you can get them acclimated to the class. When we do that in our class, and there's always that one shy person in the corner that kind of raises their hand and they feel a little uncomfortable, the whole class claps. Yay, we're mm-hmm. so happy that you're here. I mean, it's just so welcoming. They genuinely appreciate the work that we do as pound pros to bring the workout to them, and they don't want to miss, and they really hold each other accountable in such a fun community kind of way.
For anyone who is listening, hasn't yet taken the class, and maybe needs that extra little push to get past the door, what would you say to someone to bring them into a class?
Well, this is what I tell my class. I say, it's just rock and roll, guys. It's not that serious. The workout comes. The fun is there. Just come give it a try. I guarantee you will have fun. You will have a moment. If I'm doing my job right, at some point in the class, you're going to feel like a rock star. And I just want you at that moment to let go and enjoy it. I don't mind if you're offbeat. I really don't mind if you're going one way and I'm going the other way. I just want you to come give it a try and give yourself that time.
Well, Erica Lewandowski, thanks for coming in to tell us about Pound.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Erica Lewandowski is a local fitness instructor and certified Pound Pro. For more information about Pound and where to find a class, you can visit wuwm.com.
Coming up next on our Best of Health show, we break down some of the myths and misconceptions about exercise and eating during pregnancy. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Pregnancy is a taxing time on a woman's body. The cliche is that during those 9 months, a woman is doing everything for two, eating, sleeping, and exercising. And if you're used to doing all of those things just for one, understanding what's best for you and your baby can be a daunting task.
Megan Szymanski is a local fitness team leader and is pre- and postnatal fitness certified by the American Council of Exercise. She joined me for one of our Fit for You segments and explained why the old cliche might not exactly be true.
I think one of the main misconceptions is the whole eating for two. So yes, you are pregnant, you are growing something in you, which is a miracle in itself. However, the first trimester of pregnancy, you actually shouldn't even be increasing your caloric intake by all that much. So you want to follow how you feel, of course. If you have morning sickness, you might be eating more carb-based type foods. If you're hungry, absolutely, by all means, eat. But that mentality of eating for two is going to put you in a spot that you would probably not prefer to be in 9 months from now. Into the second and third trimester, you do tend to increase caloric intake by about 300 calories per day, which, to put that in perspective, is, you know, two pieces of toast with some peanut butter on it.
So not an extra milkshake.
Absolutely not. And I've actually found that women tend to, in fact, eat healthier during pregnancy because they are more conscious and aware than before they got pregnant as well.
Okay. And when it comes to exercising, what is the general rule of thumb concerning exercise during pregnancy?
So the golden rule or the rule of thumb would be not to do anything that you didn't do before you got pregnant. So if you were a runner before you got pregnant, you can continue doing your running. You know, listening to your body is the most important thing. Your body will tell you when it's too much, when you shouldn't be doing it anymore, when it starts getting uncomfortable, or it'll give you symptomatic signs that this is no longer okay. If you were lifting weights before, continue lifting weights. So you don't want to progress and try to grow your fitness levels at that point, but you should really just try to maintain where you're at for as long as possible, as long as the body allows in terms of comfort.
So what are some safe basic guidelines women can follow when it comes to frequency and level of intensity?
I prefer to use perceived exertion. So on a scale of 1 to 10, how hard are you working right now? Typically in the first trimester, if I asked you how hard are you working, you should be at about a number of 6 to 7 on that scale. Second trimester is going to be about a 5. Third trimester is going to be about a 3. So frequency will also change throughout pregnancy. Typically, earlier in pregnancy, you're going to be exercising 4 to 5 times a week. A little later in pregnancy, 3 to 4 times a week. And again, that just depends on how you feel. If you have a really rough trimester, you know, you might only exercise once or twice that week just because you really don't feel up to it and you're down and out.
What are some key muscle groups that women should strengthen in order to benefit them during the pregnancy, but also most importantly, during delivery?
Core training is absolutely by far the most important thing to focus on during pregnancy. I know it can be scary because you don't want to think about doing a sit-up when you have a baby in you. So that tends to be the thing that women shy away from the most, but that's actually the most important. So there is a very safe way to do core training. Any type of sit-up, any type of seated leg raise is okay. If you're past the first trimester, just don't lie flat on your back. Just make sure you're doing it at an incline. Planking throughout the entire pregnancy is great. Something to stay away from would be twisting motions. So aside from core training, the other thing that I really focus on is posture, upper and lower back. So as your body begins to develop and change, you're going to become very front heavy. As the breasts increase, the belly increases, all that weight goes to the front. So the stronger the back can be, the better you're going to be able to hold your shoulders back, which will help with posture and decrease back pain over time.
And what are the benefits of exercising while pregnant, not only for the body physically, but for the mother's mind and then delivery come later?
Yep. So, you know, we have such a challenge with body image as is in this society. So it's very difficult, whether you are fit before you're pregnant or not, to kind of see those changes, accept those changes, and know why they are happening. Positive reinforcement is great in terms of daily activity, and it doesn't need to be intense. I feel like it really just truly helps with confidence building and knowing that you're strong. You know, going through a labor delivery, you need endurance to do that. And the stronger you are physically, the stronger you are mentally, and vice versa.
Now, when it comes to exercising and fueling our body, we all need proper nutrition. But pregnant women also need to keep in mind extra nutrition, all the supplements they need to take, because they are supplying sources for their body and also the body growing inside them. So as you mentioned, the cliche eating for two is not really true. It does not apply. What should women be eating during pregnancy and how much?
It's a great question. Initially, again, you don't need to increase your caloric intake all that much. By all means, if you are hungry, do eat, because your body's telling you that you need those extra calories. Later on in the pregnancy, about second and third trimester, you're going to increase by about additional 300 calories per day. Something to be more aware of would be more organic type foods. So knowing what's going into your mouth, more importantly, the quality of food and what type of nutrients are coming from that food. So there is a list, the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15. The Clean 15 are going to be fruits and vegetables that you don't really have to worry about being organic because they are covered in skin, or that skin comes off, or the way that they're grown, they have more of a safer approach. That Dirty Dozen is going to be the 12 fruits and vegetables that you really want to focus on eating organically for the safety of yourself and for your baby. Small levels of caffeine are very safe for you. The recommendation is not to go over 2 milligrams of caffeine per day, which is about a 12-ounce cup of coffee. So you just don't want to overdo it. What it does, it increases your blood pressure. It increases your heart rate, which in turn does the same thing for your baby. In terms of different vitamins, so most prenatal vitamins now have added DHA and folic acid. When you look for a prenatal vitamin, your doctor will recommend that it has that in there as well. That's going to help with brain, spine, and eye development.
And what foods should pregnant women avoid?
There's a lot, kind of, but not kind of.
Dangerous foods, I should say.
Yes.
You know, instead of avoid the temptation of eating an extra gallon of ice cream. What else should they be avoiding besides leaning towards more organic or healthy foods?
Yep, you want to avoid anything that's unpasteurized. Different soft cheeses like brie, feta, and queso should not be consumed. Hard cheeses are totally fine to eat. Any raw cookie dough or cake batter, just because the eggs in it are not cooked and you have the chance for salmonella then at that point. Fish, you just want limited amounts of fish. The concern there is going to be your mercury intake. And then sushi and shellfish, you want to avoid altogether just because they are raw. Lunch meats should be avoided for the most part. If you heat them to about 165 degrees, they should be safe. I recommend staying away from them completely because there's a lot of nitrates in lunch meats, and that's one of the concerns aside from what lunch meats can carry, you know, in terms of like a salmonella or an E. coli. Those nitrates you want to keep out of your diet altogether, as well as artificial sweeteners. You know, if you're used to drinking diet soda or G2, go to those full sugar alternatives. We just don't know at this point what artificial sweeteners do. We don't have long enough studies to see how it affects us long term. So the more natural, the better, even if it is sugar.
Right. And when it comes to meats and food prep, basically when you can do the process yourself.
Yes. Yep.
That's the best option.
Absolutely.
Now, with women's bodies changing, they may not know the proper warning signs when it comes to, am I overdoing it or am I just feeling unwell because I'm pregnant? So what are some signals that women should pay attention to when it comes to, should I pull back on what I'm doing and the intensity of the exercises?
Different cautions and warning signals you should look for when exercising, that you should either specifically terminate exercise as well as call your OBGYN, would be any type of vaginal bleeding. Typically, you know, there's something more going on if you do notice that. An elevated heart rate prior to exercise. So your heart rate will elevate that much faster during exercise. However, if you notice that your heart rate is that much higher before you even begin, do not start exercising. Any dizziness, headaches, chest pain, muscle weakness, calf pain, or swelling could indicate blood clots. The other thing to really be cautious of, or to pay attention to, I guess you should say, is the fetal movement post-exercise. So once you can start feeling your baby kicking and punching and moving around and doing somersaults in you, please make sure that you can feel your baby move at least 1 to 2 hours after you are done exercising. I always, you know, as a fitness professional, ask my clients to make sure that they are still noticing that. If they're not noticing that movement and that movement was pretty consistent, that's something they should look into. If they're not feeling the movement, they can also eat something or drink some cold water. If the baby's sleeping, that should wake it up, get them moving, you know, before they kind of go into freak out mode.
Yeah, that's a good tip. I'm sure not a lot of people think about that.
Yeah.
So what is the proper exercise intensity that these pregnant women should be doing, and what kind of exercises should they avoid?
In terms of intensity, I recommend that you don't do high intensity exercise 2 days in a row. So if you're doing high intensity exercise previous to getting pregnant and you are safe and cleared to do that now, at least give yourself a day of rest. Moderate exercise, which I consider walking at 3 to 4 miles per hour, is safe to do on a daily basis. In terms of exercises to avoid, I recommend using common sense. So anything that's high risk that could cause you to fall, you don't want to land on your stomach at all, you don't want to involve a high degree of balance or agility, are not recommended.
And then fast forward 9 months or so later, after you've had the baby, when can women return to an exercise regimen?
Don't worry about exercise until 4 to 6 weeks after giving birth. So allowing enough time for your body to heal, but then also really devoting those weeks to spending time with your baby, not feeling guilty about not exercising. You know, your priorities during that time are bonding with the baby, sleeping, healing, breastfeeding. Your priorities change, so not placing too much stress on yourself.
And what should women keep in mind as they think about getting their old body back? To be realistic, because our bodies change a whole lot during pregnancy, and then after the baby is born and you're left with, you know, extra weight, other things, you're feeling a certain way, you know, what should women just keep in mind?
Keep in mind it took you 9 months to get there. It'll take you a minimum of 9 months to get back, if not longer. So it's not a quick fix. It's not what you see in magazines. You know, it's a long process. So, and you have less time, you're sleeping less, you know, it's not as much of a priority as it may have been before. So those 9 to 12 months, it's going to be a slow process.
So just try and keep a small accomplishment one day at a time.
Yep, like, one day at a time. Mm-hmm. Try to be patient. Try and keep the focus on where your priority is while still taking care of yourself. So mentally and physically, fitting exercise back into a daily routine is very important for you without stressing yourself out over it.
Right. Now we've gone through a little bit of pre-pregnancy and then after the delivery, but what key message do you want to share with women who are expecting or have already given birth and are trying to stay healthy and active?
I like to look at these 5 affirmations. Different affirmations apply to at different times, either pre or postnatal. I think it's great to have affirmations that you do repeat because the more you say it, the more you believe it. So number 1 would be, my baby is healthy, beautiful, and strong. I think it's important to know that while you're going through the process as well, to trust that everything's going to be okay, because that is that fear of the unknown and what could happen. And just knowing that you're doing everything you can in your willpower to have that healthy baby. Number 2, I honor my body exactly as it is. So it's changing. It's producing a miracle. There's a reason why you are gaining weight or why you can't fit into those jeans anymore. And just remember what that reason is. So honor your body where it is, how it looks and how it feels. Number three, I only allow positive energy in my life and in my home. Number four would be my connection to my baby grows stronger every day. It is such a cool connection to have, and until you go through it, you can't really explain it. And then number five is I will have a blissful, effortless birth filled with joy, laughter, and love. So those five affirmations I like to share. And again, each of them will apply at different times throughout your pregnancy. And when you're feeling some of these things, just repeat that to yourself and remind yourself of those things.
Well, these are great tools and information to keep in mind for women who are expecting or just thinking about it. So thanks so much for coming in and sharing this info.
Thank you for having me.
Megan Szymanski is a local fitness team leader and is pre- and postnatal fitness certified by the American Council of Exercise. You can find all of our previous Fit for You segments at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now and then return to our coffee series and walk you through some of the most common questions about coffee and your health. This is Lake Effect on WUWM.
Black coffee loves a hand-me-down broom.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. For many of us, it's hard to be a functional human being without a morning cup of coffee or two. But in a society that consumes what can be considered the most widely used drug on the planet so often, you have to wonder, is it actually good for us?
Coffee and the caffeine that's in it have been linked to dehydration, stomach problems, effects on your metabolism, and insomnia, as well as some other conditions. But what does the science say?
Local nutritionist Kim Flannery says you really don't have to quit making and drinking the black gold you so enjoy. She sat down with me to discuss coffee myths and its potential benefits.
Well, there are definitely many advantages that are coming out in the research about at least possible benefits of coffee drinking. Of course, with anything with nutrition within moderate limits, but it is associated with liver health and also a lower incidence of type 2 diabetes, which those are two wonderful things, especially the type 2 diabetes with the incidence of that in the United States right now. Also, cognitive health seem to be some benefits there, lots of studies on that. Mood can be picked up, and I can talk about that myself because I do notice a little perk beyond the energy is great, and I enjoy that, definitely getting a start on my day, but also, I do think it makes me happy. I like coffee.
Yeah, I need the first cup of the day before speaking to someone or actually trying to function with your brain.
Right.
Do you think that because of, say, your mood is better and you feel more energized, that is caffeine good for you or is it bad for you? Or is there a certain point in consumption where there's a limit?
Well, there is a limit, and let's touch on the negative points because I just touched on some positive possibilities, at least, with coffee. But for some time, there was some suspicion that possibly it was responsible for high blood pressure, which we now know it does not cause high blood pressure. But with specifically the elderly and people who are pregnant, people who should be limiting their coffee consumption, there's a definite need for that. And as everybody is different, there will be different upper limits, I would think, within, you know, some flexible guidelines. But guidelines given by the March of Dimes for pregnant women is 1 cup per day, 1 8-ounce cup. But for most people, a lot of these studies for the benefits were done on up to 3 8-ounce cups of coffee. And that seems to be fine for most people. I would say knowing your body, like for me, I'll hit a point where a little's good and I will go over that point and know it right away.
Yeah.
So I get anxious and a little, you know, edgy.
What makes that difference between someone getting jittery from 1 cup of coffee versus someone who can handle 3 or 4 cups throughout the day? Is it the way our bodies process this individually?
It depends on how your body metabolizes the coffee. Also, size, like with anything that you put into your body, alcohol or any other substance that's going to affect your body in a way like that, where it affects mood and functioning, cognitive functioning and things, size is going to make a difference. So just like a 200-pound man is going to, handle his alcohol a lot better than someone like me who's 5'3 and not a large person. Mm-hmm. Same thing with coffee. So I know my husband can, for instance, handle a couple cups more than me.
And going back to coffee and performance, you mentioned people can get a little jump start to their day and feel better, but can it aid you in exercise and in burning more calories? Does, say, having some coffee 40, 30 minutes before a workout, does that help you during that process?
I believe it does, based on the research I've looked at, and also my body as a laboratory can tell you that, yes, if I'm going out for a run, I'm going to get a better run if I have a little kickstart from that coffee. But there are, again, plenty of studies that support moderate coffee consumption for athletic performance.
Do you think that negates what your body could potentially build up to on its own if you didn't have that boost?
Good question. I think, personally, I'm interpreting the research, but seems like a little jump start above something that you could give your body. Like, you can train your body, and then if you had a cup of coffee, you'd still be a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is something there.
Okay. And what do you think quantifies as too much coffee in one day? Where does that line get crossed?
Well, recommendations looks like safe, beneficial effects were done on 3 8-ounce cups. And anything above that, probably you're getting into some iffy territory, again, size dependent. I can tell you right now that if I had 3 8-ounce cups of coffee, that would be too much for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say once you get beyond that, it's probably going to be getting on that edge of where it's really beginning to not be so good for you. Maybe even might have some negative effects of acid in your stomach and things like that.
Well, along the lines of acidity and in your stomach-wise, how coffee can either upset you or perhaps calm things down, do you think iced coffee is better for your stomach and your digestive system versus hot coffee? Does that settle in a little better and cause less acidity and less reaction?
I don't really know the answer to that. But that does bring up something that I know was some recent research that came out. There was, within the last 6 months, I think, there was an article about coffee that was too hot and cancer risk. So I don't know if you saw that. But a lot of brewed coffee, I forget the temperature above which, it can be damaging to your esophagus, which could exacerbate like a esophageal cancer risk. So something to look out for. But again, that's hot coffee. As far as how it affects your stomach is going to be an individual thing. And I know that there are also other conditions that people can have, like acid reflux, for instance, where they might be told to limit or cut out their caffeine, their coffee intake, because that can aggravate conditions like that. But I guess as far as stomach comfort goes, it would be something that would be an issue to look at individually and see how does your stomach handle that and what's the difference between one cup and four cups and what's your good level.
Mm-hmm. Is there a certain brewing method that makes coffee better for you and your ingestion of it?
I haven't seen any studies that talk specifically about a lot of different brewing methods other than the distinction between like a French press or what we might call a Turkish brewed coffee as opposed to a regular brewed coffee, or even honestly espresso is more on the beneficial end of the substance in there that is filtered out when you use a filter making your coffee, which you would not get with the French press. It's all sitting in there together. And the substance called their diterpenes, and there have been studies associated with elevated LDL cholesterol and total cholesterol with those brewing methods. So you want something that's filtered, especially if you have a heart health risk.
Do you think there's one good time to have coffee? Is it best to have just coffee in the morning, or does it benefit your body to keep having coffee throughout the day? Does it become counterproductive, I suppose, if you have it too late?
I think it does. Although some people will tell me I can have a cup of coffee at 8 o'clock at night and go straight to bed. I cannot do that. I think a lot of people cannot do that. And with a lot of the people that I have nutrition consultations with, there is a lot of insomnia going on these days, too. So for a lot of people, for most people, I think it's probably not a very good idea to have your coffee too late. For me, my cutoff is like 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm done. And I sleep well, but if I know I wouldn't if I had it into the afternoon.
So it's really about just kind of learning your limits.
Right. And I have had people tell me that they aren't affected by it. And I think possibly bodies get accustomed to what you give it. And if you ever try and wean yourself off of that, the more coffee you're drinking, probably the bigger headache you're going to have when you try and withdraw from it.
Right. And that can be attributed to also just the sheer sizes mm-hmm. that coffee can come into nowadays. So you mentioned the recommendation is an 8-ounce cup, mm-hmm. 1 cup of coffee. But yet you can get, 24 ounces and you have
right.
all of these different kind of sugary drinks. And while you say coffee is good alone, a lot of people associate coffee with adding cream and sugar. So does coffee with those added elements decrease the benefits of just having coffee alone if it were black?
Yes. It depends, too, what are you adding to your coffee. If you're adding milk, like you're having a skim latte, you're not adding a lot of extra calories. You're adding some extra calcium, vitamin D, things that your body can use. And even if you don't consume dairy, you could have a soy milk or an almond milk, which would have those nutrients in there. So that could be a positive thing. But unfortunately, when I'm in Starbucks ordering drinks, I hear a lot of orders for very good-looking drinks, that fancy drinks with a lot of sugar in them. And that definitely is a nutritional concern these days, is added sugars in our diet, which there is quite a bit of research on the negative consequences of too much added sugar. So something to watch out for sure. The calories, too, when you have the extra sugar and the extra cream and the whipped cream and all of those added goodies, you're going to have lots more calories, and then that can become a weight control issue, too.
Does all of that added sugar and fat from the cream and whipped cream, do you get a sugar high instead of a caffeine high at that point? I mean, depending on the size of the drink, I suppose, but if people are walking out of Starbucks with these massive cups topped off with whipped cream, I mean, are you really just not getting coffee at that point?
Well, you're not getting actually a lot of coffee probably, because it's so diluted with all of those other ingredients. And then we get into another question about, do you get a sugar high? You know, there's probably different research on that, too. I know research says, it contradicts the whole idea that sugar causes hyperactivity in children, but ask a mother, about that, and she may tell you differently. But again, I'm not sure if that would cause you to have, a quote-unquote sugar high. But the caffeine high would definitely, I think, be diluted by all the other things in there.
Right. And caffeine and coffee and dehydration, we're in our minds drinking a liquid.
Mm-hmm.
So we're thinking this is keeping us hydrated. But does it dehydrate us, or does it keep your body at the same level as if you were drinking water? Because it is water filtered through beans. So what does it come down to?
Well, we used to think that it was dehydrating, just as alcohol is. Alcohol is dehydrating. Coffee, not so much. The recent information that's come out on that is that possibly it's a little bit dehydrating, but not like we used to think. And so coffee and tea, those caffeinated drinks, we can still count that as part of our fluid intake for the day, maybe count it as 3/4 of a cup for every cup you drink. But it's still a pretty good fluid source. What they found was that it isn't as much of a diuretic as they had originally thought. So when you drink coffee, you're probably not losing as much fluid as we used to think. So drink water, you're going to have to go to the bathroom. If you drink a lot of coffee, you're also going to have to go to the bathroom. But it doesn't seem to be a hugely different effect. One other thing I was thinking about with the coffee is that it is a source of antioxidants, which is a benefit to it. And I was shocked when I was looking into it to find that it's actually the biggest source of antioxidants in the American diet.
Really?
And that is because of the sheer quantity of coffee that Americans drink. But isn't that fascinating?
It is. Yeah. I would be fair to guesstimate that probably at least 90% of adults have coffee at some point
sure.
in the day.
Sure.
So does that decrease the amount of vegetables we're getting? If someone hears what we're talking about right now, they're not going to be inclined
I don't say that so people stop eating their vegetables. That's not the message here.
Yeah.
Vegetables have all kinds of other things in them mm-hmm. that we still want to get fruit to. So coffee, I think the main message from all of this is if you're like me and you really enjoy that ritual of having your morning coffee and you like the taste, you like the way it makes you feel, and you don't go overboard with it, you're probably going to be getting some nice health benefits from that too. But beyond that, it's still important to look at all the other things and what you're putting into your coffee, as we talked about.
So try and keep it as black as possible.
I would say,
to be safer.
Have a little milk in it.
Okay.
And get that calcium, because for a lot of people, that could be your source of calcium for the day.
Well, Kim, it's all fascinating stuff, and I guess we'll both continue to drink our coffee. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Kim Flannery is a local registered dietitian and certified dietitian. She currently works as the nutrition director for the Wisconsin Athletic Club.
We'll take one last break and then learn about local efforts to reduce black infant mortality and improve birth outcomes. This is an All Health Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect's Best of Health show continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. There is a huge disparity between black and white infant mortality rates in this country. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, African American infants are twice as likely to die in childbirth than Caucasian infants in the United States.
In Milwaukee, the situation is even worse. Black infants are three times more likely to die than their white counterparts. But the Wisconsin Doulas of Color Collective is working to change that. The group was profiled in a piece by Naomi Waxman from Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service.
Waxman sat down with Lake Effect producer Joy Powers to talk about the collective and began by explaining how doulas help women during and after pregnancy.
So a doula is an individual who provides both emotional and physical support during various stages of pregnancy and childbirth. And so doulas are present beforehand during pregnancy to provide counseling and preparation, then during the birth itself, and then they can provide services up to several years after a child is born, and supportive services for the mother and for the family.
So how does this differ from the kind of services you would get from your average doctor?
Sure, absolutely. So a doula is not a medical professional like a midwife, for example, is. A doula provides empowerment, cultural understanding. They can provide massage. A number of doulas are also licensed massage therapists. But the services that they provide are less medical and more spiritual and emotional.
Now, as you said, doulas are not medically trained. And something you even bring up in the article is they use herbs and oils to treat women. To a lot of people, that sounds like pseudoscience. But what are the real numbers behind the efficacy of doulas? Are they proven to help women through their pregnancies?
Well, I can't speak specifically to numbers, but I think the proliferation of doulas throughout the United States speaks to a need in various communities for that kind of emotional support from outside the family unit. So somebody who isn't necessarily tied into the outcome in a familial sense, and so who can advocate for you and talk you through difficult questions or feelings without that kind of personal engagement.
So Wisconsin Doulas of Color is who you profiled for the piece. Tell me a little bit about them.
So the Wisconsin Doulas of Color Collective started to organize in 2014, but they've recently found a permanent home at the Body and Soul Healing Arts Center. So what these women were seeing was a need in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and beyond, for women of color to have access to somebody who understands their lives, somebody who can relate to them, who has walked around in their skin, essentially, in the world, and therefore is less likely to be judgmental or rule-bound. This is somebody who is there to support them and advocate for them in their times of need.
Now, what do you mean by rule-bound?
So I think sometimes people within families, there can be expectations or traditions or fear of judgment about doing the right thing or the wrong thing in regard to preparation for birth or parenting. And so this is an individual that's outside of that familial circle and so may have a little bit more of an objective view.
Now, something that the collective seems to really stress is this idea of cultural sensitivity. Why is that important specifically for pregnant women of color?
So pregnant women of color, both nationwide and in Milwaukee, experience disproportionately high rates of negative birth outcomes. So that can be premature births, that can be infant mortality. And so there is an apparent need for somebody that these women can relate to. One of the doulas that I spoke with said that a number of her clients feel that, you know, a white woman might not be able to relate or empathize in the same manner as a woman of color. So in an effort to combat the disproportionate numbers as far as infant mortality, specifically among African-American infants, they're trying a different approach than has been previously implemented.
Now, as you mentioned, of course, black infants in the city of Milwaukee have a much higher mortality rate, in fact, three times higher than that of white infants. And I think we generally attribute that to the huge wealth disparity between black and white women and all that that entails. But the collective posits another theory, which is a bit more troubling.
Yes. So the collective is not alone in their assertion that there is documentation that these extreme disparities in birth outcomes don't only affect poor African-American women. This is true of African-American women of all socioeconomic levels and all education levels. So typically, education is regarded as one of the most important factors in birth outcomes. So women in general with higher education tend to have better birth outcomes. But among African-American communities, there are numbers that demonstrate that this is not inherently the case. So some of the research that has been done on the subject probes at the idea that the chronic stress of racism is hurting these women and therefore hurting their pregnancy outcomes.
What kind of studies have been done into that?
So there was a really excellent documentary called When the Bow Breaks. And so they cite a number of studies from various sociology journals, epidemiology journals that have looked at and compared the birth outcomes of white U.S.-born women, African immigrants to the United States, and African-American women. And African immigrants to the United States and white women actually have comparable positive birth outcomes, while African-American women disproportionately have much more negative birth outcomes. So within even a single generation, these African immigrants, their daughters are now having the same negative birth outcomes as African-American women. So these studies have found that the social milieu of racism and the stress that that induces in this country is really hurting these women and their babies.
All right. Well, Naomi Waxman, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
Naomi Waxman is the current Public Policy Forum Reporting Fellow at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. To read her feature on the Wisconsin Doulas of Color Collective, you can go to WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie Noor. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next, and it's 11 o'clock.